Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Words of the Wise podcast, hosted by me, Lexi Maynard. This is your first time joining us, or if you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe for instant updates on new episodes. You can also find us on Facebook at Words of the Wise Podcast, Instagram at Words of the Wise Podcast, or on Twitter at Words of W Podcast as well. Joining us today for episode 14 is the marvelous Nancy Niemann. As she spent 38 years of her life as an educator, she has much to teach, and we all have much to learn in this episode. Here is Nancy Niemann.
Hi, folks. I'm Nancy Niemann. I'm 80 years old. I've lived a long time. Hope to live a few more. It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. So you grew up in Anderson, Indiana. What did the typical day in your childhood look like?
Well, I was born in 1940, so World War II had already started in Europe, and pretty soon it was in the U.S. as well. And so my early years were... we were poor folk. My dad worked for 25 cents an hour at a fruit market, and I'd heard stories about the Germans. I thought they were going to come and invade my bedroom, and so, you know, I had a place to hide in the closet with quilts over me so they couldn't find me, stuff like that. But basically, my childhood was perfect because we didn't have TVs. We didn't have, of course, computers and phones and all of that. So we played. We just played our hearts out. Rain or shine, Mom would let us go out as long as there wasn't lightning and thunder. We could play in the rain. And so all the kids in the neighborhood. And then once I started to school, well, kids liked to come home with me because we were unique in the fact that we still didn't have any running water in the house. We had an outside toilet, we had a pump, and so my friends from school would come and we would pump water, we would make cardboard houses in the backyard and all of that. And I had a good friend named Albert, who was my first boyfriend, probably through eighth grade, who lived near. So we had a field forest like across from us, and we would play Tarzan and Jane and, you know, just use your imaginations. We had a weeping willow tree in the front yard. And so sometimes it was a covered wagon. Sometimes it was a rainforest. So, you know, we played a lot. And, like I said, we were really poor, but I never felt poor. I always felt blessed.
So how many siblings did you have?
I just have one brother. He's 3 years younger, and he's the quiet one in the family, and I was more outgoing, but I would push him into playing things. Like, we had bunk beds, and we would make it into a covered wagon, and like play under the weeping willow tree and ride our bikes. And so, yep, life was good in Anderson in the 1940s.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Would you say that you have a favorite childhood memory?
I guess one thing would be my cousins. My mom and dad were each one of eight children. And we were especially close to my mom's side. And she had six sisters and one brother. And so I had all of these cousins. And so we were always staying all night. In fact, three of them that were closest to my age, all their names were Judy, because our grandma's name was Julia. And so they used different forms like Judith and Julia and Judy as when they named their kids. So they'd be a little bit different. But we just had a lot of fun together and just a lot of family. There was a lot of family to have fun with.
Did you have a job growing up?
Oh, my, yes. I don't know. 11 or 12, I started babysitting. When the summers when I was 14 and 15, one of my aunts and uncles owned a bait shop and a restaurant at Geist Reservoir. And so in the summertime, my dad and I, as soon as he got off work at General Motors, we would drive to Geist. And I worked from 7 at night till, 6 at night till 6 in the morning in the restaurant. One of the hardest jobs I ever had. And I can't remember if it paid 50 cents an hour, maybe a little bit more than that. But let me earn enough that I had some money for school clothes, because up until that time, all of my school clothes were either hand-me-downs or my mom, who was a great seamstress, made me a lot of clothes. So, but I liked to work. And then by the time I was a sophomore in high school, there was a neighborhood confectionery. I don't know if you know that term, but it was kind of like an old pantry, village pantry kind of thing. It was small, but we had a soda fountain and ice cream and just a little magazines and just a little bit of this and that. And I started working there my sophomore year in high school and worked actually until a few days before my wedding and after I graduated from college. So oh, wow. I always had a job. And in college, I worked in the dean of men's office during the week and then went home and worked in the confectionery on the weekends. So I never felt begrudged. That was one of the greatest things my parents gave me, was a work ethic. I enjoyed my jobs. I enjoyed the people I met when I did the jobs. So work was never work for me.
Yeah. So what did the typical Saturday night look like for you in high school?
Oh, my gosh. I'm an Anderson Indian. And so everything was around sports. And once an Indian, always an Indian. And so there were football games and basketball games. And back in the 50s, you always went steady with somebody. And, you know, that might last a few weeks or it could last a couple of years or whatever. A lot of dances and ball games, the confectionery, those people were really nice and would let me off for they liked basketball, so I always got to be off for the basketball games. We had cheer blocks and just nothing that cost much money because we never had money. And sometimes it would be, you would just drive around and there would be, I can't think of anything in Muncie right now that would compare to it, but you would drive around. The restaurants had car hops and such, so you would go out I think there was a Frisch's Big Boy then, but places, and ride around, see who else was there, and if you didn't have money to buy anything, you would park the car and then go get in the car with somebody that was up there that had money and already ordered drinks or whatever. But yeah. It was a place to visit and have fun. And I loved high school. Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. Who did you look up to as a kid, as a young woman, would you say?
Of course, your parents. They mold a lot what you are, you know, and educators. Oh, I loved almost all my teachers. And so you respected adults then. And I'm not saying kids today don't respect adults, but. You just wouldn't think of back-talking anyone. And if they told you something, you just assumed it was true. Also, you knew if you got in trouble at school, you got in trouble at home. Mm-hmm. Now, the first few years I taught, sometimes I had parents come in who were going to punish me because I had punished their child. And it was such a shock to me because I thought, I don't believe this, because if I got in trouble when I was in school, well, you were going to be in big trouble at home, I can tell you.
So you already have kind of talked about your parents and the work ethic that they taught you. Would you say that's the greatest thing that your parents taught you, or what would you say is the greatest thing they taught you?
That and education. Dad only made it through eighth grade. They grew up during the Depression. Times were hard, and Dad started the eighth grade three times but had to stop when he got a job, some kind of a job that he could help support his family, which I said had eight kids. So, and so education was big to them. And since it was fun for me, I just knew that was going to be an important part in my life. Of course, when I was in eighth grade, we had a career day and you had to tell what you wanted to be when you grew up. And I said, ooh, I would like to be a lawyer and then become the first woman president. And so then after I went to college, I had to change my mind because I realized I wasn't smart enough to be a lawyer and I was too smart to be president.
Speaking of college, so you went to Ball State. What all went into that decision of you going there?
Well, first was money. When I told my parents that I was going to college, they were shocked. It was like, you know, deer caught in the headlights, because there was no money. But the good thing was that it was quarters then instead of semesters. So you went three quarters and then had the summer off. And it was only $50 a quarter. And so I could work. So I would work all summer. And then I, like I said, I had jobs on campus and off. And so I was able to pay my way. Kids today can't do that. You know, it's so expensive. Plus, the jobs that they're able to get don't, you know, match up to what the costs are. So Ball State was the only option, but a lot of my friends from Anderson went to Ball State. And our freshman year, a lot of us commuted. And then second and third year, I lived off campus, and it was only $9. And I think maybe it started $8 the first quarter, and she raised it to $9 a quarter. And I wrote a letter to the editor at the Ball State paper, because I didn't know where I was going to get that extra dollar, you know. But now I look back and think, how lucky, my whole life that I've been growing up, that things worked for you, because I could work and I could pay my way through, and that didn't put an extra pressure on my parents. So that was good.
Yeah. You said that you changed your major. So you started off like thinking that you were going to be a lawyer.
Yeah, pre-law.
Yeah. At what point did you decide to change your major? Like, how old were you?
Actually, it probably was my sophomore year. And probably the main reason was French.
Oh.
Because to get a Bachelor of Arts, you had to have 2 years of a foreign language. And in high school, I took Latin, which at that time a lot of people did, and it didn't seem to help me any. And I really struggled with the French. I don't have the ear where I can, you know, when, just like Americans, how we'll see, I'll see you this morning. You know, we run words together. Yeah. And that's how the French did, and I couldn't hear it. So after it took six quarters to get a Bachelor of Arts. I lasted five quarters. And then I decided that teaching was a better fit for me.
What would you say is your favorite college memory?
Well, I didn't get to socialize much like the kids do today, because I didn't live in a dorm or belong to a party. And so, but I loved it. And I loved it when I was able to live off campus, and we walked everywhere. My boyfriend and future husband, he didn't have a car, nor did I. So we walked uptown, we walked every place. And so I loved all of the seasons, except the rainy season. I liked all my professors. I liked school. I liked Ball State.
Mm-hmm. And how do you say Ball State today compares to Ball State then?
Well, looking at the campus, wow. I think Ball State has a beautiful, beautiful campus. And like two of the dorms, when I was in school, they were called North Hall and South Hall. They were actually old army barracks that they had pulled in.
Oh, wow.
And so they didn't have the fancy dorms like they did today and all of that. But I imagine there maybe were 5,000 students who went to Ball State during the time I was there. And, of course, that's about quadrupled now. And so getting to know people, meeting people from different backgrounds and everything. And of course, John made it nice.
Mm-hmm. So what year did you finally graduate?
I graduated in 1962 in May. And then I worked three jobs during the summer until August when we were married.
Okay. So what was your first job out of college?
Well, I was so excited to get a job. But it was at Union City, and it was fifth grade language arts, which is kind of funny because my daughter Chris and my granddaughter Katie both teach fifth grade now. But that wasn't my age group, I found out soon. And I also found out that I was pregnant, and at that time you could not teach and be pregnant, which was better than when I was in elementary school, because in elementary school, you could not even be married and teach.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So I took 2 years off of teaching after Union City and had my beautiful children, 63 and 64.
All right. And then you went back to work after that?
And then I went back to work after that, started social studies at Eaton, and made a lot of friends there. A lot of my students actually are still friends, and one of them ended up marrying my daughter.
Oh, yeah, Al. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
What a cool story. So when did you finally go to Delta Middle School?
Well, it was a progression because it was when I started, it was grades kindergarten through 12 at Eaton. And then pretty soon it became Northdale Middle School. And it was just the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade was there. And then when the new high school at Delta was built, well, we moved to Rorton, to the old high school. And then eventually Albany came in with us, and then our name was changed to Delta Middle School. So you can either say I started from the very beginning, I mean, because it was at Eaton, and then we all the parts came together and became Delta Middle School.
Oh my gosh, so you were there from the beginning.
Yeah.
Wow. What would you say is your favorite memory from teaching?
Oh, the kids. And I taught U.S. history and journalism. And that was fun. We did the newspaper and the yearbook. And my husband started the academic teams in Delaware County, and he encouraged me. And so I started the academic teams at Delta Middle School. And so, you know, just the extra things were fun. The pep sessions, oh my gosh. And we would have yelling contests with the kids. Eighth graders, what's your cry, you know, and they would yell. And then they would say, teachers, what's your cry? And we would try to out-yell the eighth graders. And, of course, now with COVID, you can't yell, you can't do any of the fun things. Pardon me, but no, it's so different.
What did teaching middle school kids teach you?
Well, you had to find your spot. I apologize to anyone listening who happens to be have a child who's a sixth grader, but I kind of felt like the sixth graders were brain dead. Bless their hearts. Their bodies were growing and their brains were kind of standing still for a while. And they were the young ones. You know, you have sixth, seventh, and eighth, so they're kind of wary. And seventh grade was okay, but I didn't appreciate the subject matter so much. So I fell in love with eighth graders, and they were so hormonal. And one day they would be kids, and the next day they would be almost adults, you know, and they were a surprise every day. Mm-hmm. And so you just had to go with the flow. You had to laugh and appreciate them. And still not try to be a buddy. You know, there had to be that line there. But yeah, we had field trips, and we flew to Washington, D.C. for one-day trips, and we went to ball games, and we went to Chicago to the museums. And so seeing the kids outside of school, that was really important, so they could see you as a person. And going to their events, I tried to always go to at least one of everything, track, cross country, basketball, wrestling, whatever, you know, because you need, you know, I think the teachers needed to support the kids in the things that they were interested in.
Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to teachers in today's day and age?
Well, I supervised a lot of student teachers, and I think probably the biggest mistake that student teachers made was it's such a quick change, you know, from student to being on the other side and being the teacher. And so they wanted the kids to like them, and they wanted to be buddies. And it took them sometimes a while to learn. You have to draw that line there. If you respect them, they'll respect you. They can eventually like you, but you don't start out trying to make them like you. You have to be the adult in the room, you know? So I think that's hard to all of a sudden, you know, you're in your sweats and running around campus and going to parties, and all of a sudden you're supposed to be in the classroom and be the teacher, you know. So I would say, don't try to be friends to begin with. If it's meant to be, you'll become friends, but you have to be the adult.
When did you finally retire?
Well, I can't remember if it was 35 or 36 years, in 2000. And so I've been retired for 20 years. And my husband worked one more year, and he wanted me every month to have an adventure. So before he retired, and because we both like to do adventures, we eventually hit all 50 states and had a lot of fun. So one of my adventures that first year, I was crazy about Julius LaRosa, who I'm sure you have never heard of, but he was back at the time of Elvis. But I went to the state fair and saw him, fell in love with him, wrote poems and letters to him, and he sent pictures and stuff back. And so then when I was at Delta Middle School, we would have fun lunches in the teacher's room. We would have Route 66 or all different things. And one time I wanted to have a Julius LaRosa day. And they said, well, why don't you just call him and invite him? And I thought, well, you don't think I will. So I got on the telephone. I called multiple sclerosis or whatever charity it was that he always seemed to arrive on. And they finally got me with his agent. And his agent, we laughed and talked. And he said, I like you. I'm going to give you his telephone number for where he is right now. So I actually got to call. I was still teaching then, and talk to Julius LaRosa. So my first adventure after retirement, he was going to be in Frankenmuth, Michigan, and so I wrote a letter to the place where he was going to be and said that I was going to come and bring some of my teacher friends, retiree friends, which I did. And then afterwards, when they're doing autographs, went up and I said, I'm sure you don't remember me. And he said, Nancy, is that you? My teacher friends they just giggled because they just thought it was hilarious. And I, of course, you know, he had my heart for sure.
So why did you retire?
Well, I think that a teacher, depends on what grade you are, but basically a teacher has to have a lot of energy. Are you in education?
No, I'm not.
Well, you have to have a lot of energy. And I could see in my late 50s that I was slowing down. If I didn't want to go to their events, if I wanted to just go home and relax, if I didn't want to do the newspaper or the academic teams and those extras, then I needed to step aside and let somebody with more energy come in. So I just made up my mind, checked out, and started a new life.
Yeah.
That was just as fun as the old one.
So you've spoken about your husband, John. How did you meet him?
John. Well, the first time I caught anyone cheating in my classroom, I would tell them the story of John and I, because he sat next to me in a history class. He came in, he smelled so good. He had Old Spice, and he wore this raincoat, whether it was raining or not. He has beautiful blue eyes. Anyway, one day he said to me, have you studied for this test? And I said, yes, I have. And he said, I didn't. He said, I partied last night. Could I cheat off of you? And I said, And so we had the test, and the scores came back. And he knew some I didn't know. And so he got a better score than I did. And so I told my students, I said, I want you to look in front of you, and behind you, and beside you. Is there anybody there you want to spend your life with? Because I was so upset with him, I decided to punish him, and I married him, and I'm still punishing him today.
So how old were you then?
When we were in college, I started at 18, and when we met, I guess I was 19.
Awesome. What was your first date?
Ball State homecoming. And again, we had no car, no money, but we went to the parade and to the activities that were free, you know, and we laughed the whole time. And so then he started calling me about every night. But sometimes he would ask me about other girls that had asked him on dates or things. And he would ask me if I thought what I thought about them and so forth. And so we started out really good friends and just laughing and became friends first. And then it developed into more.
Yeah. How did you know he was the one?
Everything we talked about, it just seemed like we agreed so much. Family was important, and, you know, it's just, I don't know, just a closeness, and you just know. They're just, all of a sudden you think, wow, when did that happen, you know? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, family was important to him, and it was important to me, and his mother lived in Dunkirk. My parents lived in Anderson, and we were halfway in the middle, and that worked great.
How did he propose to you, and when?
Well, it was, would have been our junior year, in October, and things were old-fashioned then, and so the first thing he did was invite my parents out to dinner, which was really a biggie because we never had money to go to dinner, and of course, so my dad ended up paying. But anyway, he asked my dad for my hand in marriage, mm-hmm. and then the ring came soon after that.
Mm-hmm. How old were you? So your junior year, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. So then, when was your wedding? What's your anniversary?
We were married almost 58 years.
Mm-hmm. What was your wedding date?
August the 4th, 1962.
And what was your wedding like?
Oh my gosh. So simple compared to today. You know, my granddaughter, Maddie, got married recently, and oh, it was beautiful. But it was it was in a barn, and there was food for everybody, and dancing, and music, and pictures, and, just a big deal. In my day and age, it was, you got married in the church, you walked across the hallway, you had cake and punch, and the people went home. So, you know, it was a lot simpler. And since John and I were, you know, I was just getting out of school and money was tight, my aunt said she would give me $50 for a wedding dress and to put toward my wedding dress. So I searched high and low until I found a wedding dress for $50. And so my wedding dress was paid for.
Did you go on a honeymoon or anything like that?
Oh, yes, we did. And because we never had any money in college, we had gotten some money for wedding gifts. And we had, when we got ready to leave, my dad asked if we needed any money. And we said, no, we had plenty. Because we had $120. Well, we used to split a 15-cent egg salad sandwich at the Tally Ho, you know, for lunch. And so $120, wow, that was big. And my dad had just gotten a new Buick Special powder blue convertible, beautiful. It was a small. And so we headed out in that thinking we had the hold of the world, boy, because we had a convertible, we had $120, and boy, that money did not last long. We were home from Florida, down to Florida and back in 6 days. And we had change in our pocket, and that was it. Just enough money to buy gas to get home.
So did you move into a house right when you got back?
No. As a matter of fact, that's where we met our first couple friends together. We lived 2 years in the Ball State Trailer Park, and it was only $25 a month. And it took care of everything, like water and electricity. The only thing that you had to buy, you had to pay for the propane gas to heat with, and you had to pay for a telephone. And so those first 2 years we lived there, I taught the first year, and we saved half my salary. I only made $4,200, but we saved half of it, which was a good thing, because then the next year, the second year, John was still in college, and so we had that money to live on for another year in the Ball State. So after 2 years there, we pulled the trailer in the backyard here on Hollywood Avenue, couple blocks from Ball State, and here I have been ever since.
You were married for 58 years, right?
Almost, yes.
Yeah. What would you say is the key to a successful marriage?
Communication. Don't keep secrets from each other. Talk to each other. Compromise. Oh, my goodness. Both of our parents had made us feel, because we were the first college graduates, and they made us feel like we were just knew everything. So we thought we knew everything, and neither one of us knew anything. And so compromise is really, 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 really big. And family, laughter, oh my goodness. You know, I think you need to have laughter every single day. If you don't, there's something wrong in your relationship.
What advice would you give to young couples right now?
Pretty much the same. Compromise, compromise, communicate, communicate, laugh, laugh at each other, with each other. You know, you just have to learn and learn to pick your fights. Don't pick over whether the food's too salty or what movie you're going to or stupid things, you know. Save those few things that you fight about to be important things, not silly little things.
And you lost your husband 2 years ago. How does his legacy still live on?
Oh, this is... No. His kids... Just a minute. His kids, his grandkids, the kids he taught, friends. He was a great storyteller. Oh, my goodness. He had a story about any subject you wanted to bring up. And the most amazing memory. So in later years, I had to believe everything he told me he remembered, because my memory wasn't that great. Yeah. And so I had to rely on him to remember 20, 30 years ago or whatever. But yeah, he was a great storyteller. His students loved him.
He sounds like a great, great man.
Yep.
You have two children.
Yep.
And what are their names?
John Jacob Demon III, and which he'll kill me for saying this, but when he was young, people would ask his name, and he would say John Jacob Demon to a turd. And so, and then less than a year after he was born, Christina Michelle, who is the one who married Al Holdren. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of Irish twins. I always joked when I was younger that I wanted to have twins. So they were about as close together as you can get. Yeah. And they were about 11 months apart. And the way their birthdays fell, they ended up starting school the same year. And so Chris was like the youngest in her class. John was one of the older ones in their class. And so they graduated the same year. And like I said, went through pretty much like twins.
Yeah, that's so fun. Do you have any particularly funny parenting stories from when your kids were little?
Oh, just good stories. You know, they just, I was so lucky, because I would hear my friends say, I'm going to use an anonymous name here, but I would hear my friends say, Jeremy, I'm not going to tell you again. Jeremy, I'm not going to tell you again. And I never had this. That John and Chris, they just were very good children. Mm-hmm. They just great. And we liked for them to bring their friends here. And when they were between 6th and 7th grade, we were blessed to be able to buy a little, what some would call a shack at Elm Lake, which was actually a big gravel pit, had about 25 cottages around it, started like a fishing little fishing lake. And so we had the church youth group and neighborhood friends, and it just became a gathering pet place. So it was fun for us, because we got to see all their friends, and we got to see what they were doing and where they were doing it.
Yeah.
One of their friends said, "You're so nice, you always let us blah blah." And I said, "Oh, nope, I'm not nice. I just want to know what's going on." So, but we had lots of fun at Elm Lake. Lots of friends there too. Been blessed all the way through. Trailer court friends, neighborhood friends, Elm Lake friends, teaching friends. So, friends galore. That's been good.
Mm-hmm. What lesson did you stress the most to your kids when they were little?
Well, you know, I asked Chris that because that's hard for you to look back and think, you know. And she said honesty and truthfulness. And, you know, because you don't realize what you're doing. You try to set a good example. It's a lot easier to say yes than no. And sometimes you have to say no when you really want to let them do something, but you know it's not best for them. But you also have to let them know that you're there no matter what, you are there.
What would you say is the most rewarding part about being a parent?
Just how they turn out. You know, being so proud of everything that they do and the adults they become.
Mm-hmm. What would the Nancy of today tell herself as a young wife and mother?
I wouldn't change anything, but I guess I'd just say hang on and enjoy the ride. Don't stress the small stuff, you know. Don't worry about the little things and just be there and be with your family.
How many grandkids do you have?
I've been blessed with two wonderful granddaughters, Katie Holdren, who teaches fifth grade at Rorton, and there, Maddie Fox, who now teaches seventh grade at my old stomping grounds of Delta Middle School. Mm-hmm. Very proud of them both. I guess you would say that teaching is kind of our family business.
Yeah. What's your favorite part about being a grandma?
Oh, man. They spoil you rotten. You know, when they're younger, well, you can spoil them and then send them home. And then when they become older, well, then they just spoil you to death. And I love every minute of it.
Yeah. Do you have any funny stories from when they were little?
Oh, they just were neat and brought so much laughter to us all the time. At Elm Lake, we had a golf cart, and we would ride around and around there just singing songs. And John built them the most beautiful playhouse to play in next to ours. And so they spent a lot of time with us at Elm Lake. And I love being able to babysit with them. And we had like one day a week where I would pick them up from school. And when they were younger, just go sit by the airport and watch the planes come in. And they just had, they both had different personalities. Maddie was the curly-haired bouncing girl, and she was a hoot, always brought laughter. Katie was a little more serious, but honestly, like, we love to play cards. She did too. And one time I said to her, "Katie Holdren, are you cheating?" And she said, "Yes." she's quite a gal, she is. Both of them are.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of your granddaughters and your daughter's family, they were the ones who started Secret Families. Can you describe how that started?
Well, started actually in 2004, and Chris and Al decided not to buy each other a gift, but to adopt a needy family and buy gifts for them. So they bought gifts, and on Christmas Eve, they were wrapping up those gifts, getting ready to for delivery. And our son, John, showed up on Christmas Eve and liked what they were doing. So they took his credit card and ran to buy for a second family. So that was the first year. And so every year, people would hear about it, and they say, "I want to help. What can I do? What can I do?" So some people donate, some people shop, some people wrap, some people deliver. So now there are hundreds, literally, of people who are involved in the process. Al's sister, Janet, has been wonderful with leading the calling team, and that's what I do. We call the people, the families. Now, Al and Chris don't select anyone. The school principals do. And so the principals give us a list of families that they think would qualify and be needy. And so we call and we interview them and ask them all about the kids and their ages and what they would like for Christmas and that kind of thing. So that gives the shoppers some place to start and to do the shopping and all. And now it's spread so that I think there are at least 7 counties in Indiana that have started that have spun off and started their own secret families, yeah. And at least one other state in Kentucky. So it's become quite a big deal. Now, this year, they haven't told me yet, but it probably will be a little bit different because of the COVID. So, you know, about the wrapping and people being so close. Toyota Muncie has been absolutely wonderful. So they jumped in and have opened all of their facilities for wrapping and delivery team, because they also will deliver a tree if the people want a tree. Yeah. They'll deliver even a live tree and some decorations for the tree if the family wants it. So it's amazing. That's mm-hmm. all just amazing.
And can you describe how proud you are of your daughter and her family for starting that and having such an impact on our community?
No, because I'll cry. Oh. They're great.
Mm-hmm. They are.
And it's great when people bring their children and the kids get to participate. And when they realize that not all families have Christmas like they do. And then the families that are helped, then very often those families come and volunteer to help shop or wrap for other families. So that's a neat part of it too.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain what procedure you just had done?
Oh, it's not a big deal. I had an issue with a spot on my head and it wouldn't go away. Had it checked and it was malignant. And so they got me right in, went as an outpatient, and they got all of it. And it's just wonderful that we have nice wigs today, because I am absolutely bald on the whole top of my head now, which is a terrible visual, I'm sure. But I'm just thankful the doctor found it, and it's all gone.
Yeah, it looks great. I would have never guessed.
See, you can have any color you want. I tried to find one for my Colts, but I haven't found an appropriate one yet for my Colts games.
Oh, man. So, we're almost done. You've done great so far, by the way.
Thank you. Yes. I'm sorry about being so emotional.
No, don't apologize at all.
I have Pepsi commercials, so you know.
Okay, so as you look back on your life, who are the people who have influenced or impacted you the most?
Well, your parents, your educators, every friend along the way. I mean, you know, different stages of your life. And, well, for example, one of my close friends is from kindergarten. You know, they go back that far. And then neighborhood friends that are 50 years that I've had for 50 years or more. And of course, the teachers I taught with, you learn things from people that you want to be a part of your life, and things you know that isn't how you want to do it. But even that is a lesson, because when you realize how hurtful something can be, well, then you know, okay, I've done that before. I don't ever want to do that again because that was hurtful. So you learn something from every single person that touches your life.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite memory or time period of your life?
No, that's what's extraordinary, I think, about my life, is that I don't want to go back and relive anything. I've just enjoyed every single part of it. And there are good and bad things about every part. You just get over the bad and move on.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Do you regret anything?
No. I hope I haven't hurt anyone, but if I have, I apologize.
What advice would you give to my generation?
Well, today especially, people who go on to college, try not to borrow so much money. I know people who are married and have children are struggling to pay back loans. And so if you have the opportunity to work and participate in paying for your education, I think that that is good. You still need to have fun and have some parties and do things, but also take a little more responsibility for the economic part of your education. Because John and Chris, we could only afford to pay their tuition, and they were not involved in sports, so they worked all the way through college. And so they graduated without debt. And when Maddie and Katie went through, well, Al and Chris were lucky that both girls were athletic, and they Katie with golf and Maddie with tennis, and that paid for a good bit of their education. So, you know, whatever talents you have, use them to try to get that expense down.
Mm-hmm.
And try to shoot for a job you love. You're going to have to work most all your life. So hopefully you find a spot where you really love your job.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe is the most important thing in life?
Love, faith, family, and laughter.
Mm-hmm. And then last question, what do you hope to be remembered by?
Something funny, something that will make people laugh.
Mm-hmm. What's your typical day like right now?
Anything I want it to be. Every day is Saturday, and I can choose to sleep as late as I want. I don't see my friends. I hate that because of the COVID and because we're in that high-risk category. But if I feel shut in, I just get in the car, grab a book, take it to McDonald's, sit in the parking lot and watch the traffic and read my book. So for the last 20 years, I've gone to Florida for 3 months during the winter, and this will be my first year not to do that. So I'm not looking forward to shoveling snow, but I do absolutely love the looks of the first snow. It's like God puts something white and clean, and you get to start all over again. I just love that winter look.
Yeah. What do you think of the whole COVID situation?
I just think it's scary. I think I think all we can do is just hang on. But I think that we need to think of someone other than ourselves. When you wear a mask, you're actually protecting somebody like me, or someone with health issues, or a baby, or whatever. And so we've somehow got to get this under control. And each new thing that comes along, some generations had a world war, you know. There's a lot of division in our country right now. We've just got to find a way to get back to getting along and loving each other.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that's pretty much it. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you so much for thinking of me. I really appreciate it. Be careful.
I will.
Take care of yourself.
Yes.
Thank
yes.
you very much.
No, thank you.
Bye-bye. Right.
Bye. Love, faith, family, and laughter. These are the things Nancy Neiman has prioritized throughout her life. A life that she says she has enjoyed each step of the way over the last 80 years. Through the good and the bad, Nancy always remains positive, constantly feeling blessed and laughing no matter what the circumstance. Although she hopes to be remembered as something funny, she will be remembered for much more than this, for she has impacted so many, not just through teaching, but through simply living. What a light Nancy Neiman is to the world. So, the Colts won, right?
Oh, yeah. They just finished. Actually, they moved the game to 4:30. So, they just finished 20, 25 minutes ago. They won. Life is good.
Ooh, yeah.